something happening down on the farm, and the white coats say it ain't no harm, but I've got to say it don't look that way to me. Well, I've always been an animal lover, and I know cows don't eat each other, so where's the big surprise in BSE? So what you saying, minister? Don't you think it's kind of sinister? It's the profit margin, all that you can see. You broke Mother Nature's golden rules. Now you're feeding kids in schools the fruits of your ungodly company. Well, you know it don't sit well with me that schoolboy curiosity is messing with an unsuspecting nation. Well, you gotta see what this could mean.
Direct actions that focus on uprooting and destroying biotech plantings and experimental facilities are on the rise in the U.S. as well as abroad. Government officials have denounced this as eco-terrorism, and even many opponents of genetic crops have criticized the tactic. Is this wanton destruction, as the critics claim, or an act of self-defense necessary to avert a crisis, as proponents claim? This is no academic question for us here in the Finger Lakes, where Cornell University is spearheading the construction of a biotech park addition to the Agricultural Experiment Station in Geneva. The producers of this program believe that the biotech park must be stopped. If you are already convinced of that yourself, please remember to voice your opinion by calling Governor George Pataki, Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno, and Assembly Majority Leader Sheldon Silver, as well as your own Assembly member and Senator. If you're not yet convinced, I hope that the information we're about to present will convince you. You may be aware that there is a bill before the legislature that would place a 5-year moratorium on the planting of GMOs in New York State while comprehensive studies are done to determine their safety to health and the environment. Under pressure from Cornell and other biotech interests, experimentation has now been excluded from the moratorium, and experimentation is the most dangerous aspect. If you think that federal agencies are keeping a sharp eye on this, think again. The Agribusiness Examiner recently reported that a major ecological disaster was narrowly averted only by chance.
U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, treating the world's soil like dirt. In 1992, the Environmental Protection Agency was only a few weeks away from ending life on the planet as we know it. So writes George Lawton in the April 2001 issue of Acres USA, A Voice for Eco-Agriculture. Lawton reports that the EPA, although only having done limited tests at that time on a variety of genetically engineered microbes, all of which had been approved for release into the atmosphere, were prepared to approve the release of a GE variant of Klebsiella planticola, KP, one of the most common bacteria on the planet. This particular variety of KP, he writes, had the unique ability to convert dead plant matter into alcohol. It was hoped that this would provide a way for farmers to transform their unused stalks, leaves, and other types of compost material into alcohol, which could be used for washing, running vehicles, etc. The EPA had done a variety of tests on this organism, all of which indicated that it would not be toxic to humans or animals. They were only a few weeks away from releasing these bacteria into the wild when Michael Holmes, a graduate student at the University of Oregon, came looking for an interesting thing to study for his doctoral thesis. Under the direction of his academic advisor, Elaine Ingham, Holmes elected to do his thesis on the effects of this genetically engineered KP on plants, something which had not occurred to the EPA, as it was not required for the release of new genetically modified organisms, Lawton notes in his Acres USA expose. Holmes' study revealed, after testing samples of plants growing in sterile soil, soil with regular KP and soil with genetically engineered KP, that no plants in the latter soil were growing as the alcohol produced by the bacteria had killed them all. At the time, Lawton notes, the EPA was envisioning that farmers would use these bacteria in a kind of fermenting process to convert plant material into a mixture of 17% alcohol and 83% mineral sludge, which could be poured off into the soil and reused. If that had occurred, the genetically engineered KP could have colonized the entire planet over the course of several years, turning all of the soil where it grew into barren dirt. Ingram said that the problem was and still is that the EPA only looks at the immediate impact of new genetically modified organisms on animals and does not take into account the larger impact on the ecosystem as a whole. That approach can work to a limited extent when working with chemicals, which can break down and dissipate over time. But living organisms have the ability to procreate and overwhelm the natural ecosystem. After the Holmes research, Ingram claims the EPA didn't accept their findings. Further, she said that she received considerable flack from the EPA, which also objected to Holmes' graduation because they thought his research was flawed. The EPA repeated the experiment but never released the results to the general public. Ingram believes that the EPA was trying to hide the results because they were under pressure from chemical seed and biotech companies. She feared, Holmes says, if we had not done the testing, the EPA would have allowed its field use in 2 weeks. We just happened to be working on that for academic interest. What would have happened if they had not done that work? What kind of unexpected effects are already out there? Hopefully nothing as devastating as this organism, but we don't know because they have not been tested. The EPA applied the rules mandated by the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act and the Toxic Substances Control Act and found no problems with the microbe, so it was approved for field testing. Ingram explained, clearly the current regulatory methods are totally inappropriate. The work we were doing was not normal work for engineered organisms. The regulatory testing is appropriate for chemicals, but not appropriate for biological things that reproduce. If we were going to do appropriate testing, we should use the system developed by the Edmonds Institute in Edmonds, Washington. They publish a biosafety handbook, which goes through all the testing that should be required to assess the potential effects of genetically engineered organisms. This was the first organism capable of surviving in the soil. KP is found in the root systems of all the plants we have looked at, and it exists in decomposing plant material everywhere in the world. It is one of the few organisms that is everywhere, she adds. As Lawton points out, the problem with any organism, and particularly with bacteria, is that there is no surefire way to recall them once they have been released. Even plants pose a problem. Despite the possibility of mechanical control, imagine how hard it would be to selectively kill something that cannot even be seen with the naked eye. And Ingram observes, we have never been good at recapturing any organisms we have released into the world.
The problem with GMO plantings in general is that they can't realistically be confined to the field where they are being grown. Farmers who are growing organic or conventional crops have no way to stop genetic pollution of their fields due to the transfer of pollen by wind or insects. Now, even buying GMO-free seed for certain crops in North America is becoming almost impossible, according to a May 1st report released by Crop Choice News. It was titled, "All Organic Seeds Now Appear to Be Contaminated with Genetically Modified Crops." That was the gist of declarations by two organic agriculture organizations to describe the effect of transgenic crop production on organic farming. As is the case with conventional soy, corn, and canola, organic crops have tested positive for the presence of foreign genetic material because of cross-pollination and seed stock contamination. The inability to segregate transgenic crops from their organic and conventional counterparts during harvest, handling, transport, and milling is also responsible for contamination. The Organic Federation of Australia declared that contamination from transgenic crops in the United States has spread to such a degree that it cannot verify the purity of imported organic ingredients. Farm Verified Organic, seconded that assertion. A press release from the North Dakota Certification Agency stated, quote, "The GM pollution of American commodities is now so pervasive, we believe it is not possible for farmers in North America to source seed free from it." Close quote. The widespread adoption of GM crops in the U.S. makes it difficult to ensure that grain is not being contaminated with genetically modified organisms, GMOs, as it is handled and transported from the field to the end customer. Industry insiders even question whether the foundation parent seed for non-GM varieties can meet a 1% purity level, according to the November 2000 edition of Farm Industry News. David Gould, a member of the certification committee of Farm Verified Organic, discussed the contamination situation with Crop Choice in February. "Our investigations thus far from the 2000 harvest lead us to believe that virtually all the seed corn in the United States is contaminated with at least a trace of genetically engineered material, and often more," Gould said. "Even the organic lots are showing traces of biotech varieties." He pointed out the now familiar Starlink corn fiasco. Iowa's farmers planted 1% of their crop with Starlink. By harvest time, 50% registered positive for the genetically engineered variety. Since his preferred option of a ban on transgenic crops probably won't happen soon, Gould favors establishment of a maximum tolerance level for genetically modified organisms in organic crops. Currently, there is no universal standard. In the case of corn, he said that if organic certifiers insisted on 0% contamination, we shouldn't certify any corn. At the same time, he worries that propagating transgenic crops year after year will lead to the presence of more and more foreign genes in organic and conventional varieties. This, in turn, would mean raising the tolerance levels. Whether the organic stamp of approval would then become something of a joke is open to debate. But one should remember that organic standards have to do with production, not purity, said Annie Kirschenman of Farm Verified Organic. This means that testing for any kind of residue, be it from pesticide or genetic drift, is not part of determining whether to certify a farm as organic. And that was from the May 1st, 2001 edition of Crop Choice News. Monsanto, one of the largest biotech corporations, has engaged in a variety of strategies to demolish resistance to its products. It has attempted to bribe Canadian regulators and spent millions of dollars in campaign donations in order to place its executives in key government positions. Now, Greenpeace is charging that it is also resorting to smuggling in GMO seeds into countries that have not approved such plantings in order to contaminate crops and render anti-GMO laws irrelevant.
Monsanto's illegal GM corn found planted in Argentina. From the Greenpeace website, greenpeace.org. Greenpeace has demanded a full investigation into illegal planting of genetically engineered GE corn in Argentina and a disclosure of the new cover-up involving agribusiness giant Monsanto. According to information leaked to Greenpeace, substantial amounts of Monsanto's herbicide-resistant Roundup-ready corn, GA21, were planted last year in Argentina's three main corn production provinces of Buenos Aires, Santa Fe, and Cordoba. This GE variety has not been approved for planting or human or animal consumption in Argentina or for import to Europe. While the Argentinian Secretariat of Agriculture confirmed the case on Thursday, Monsanto claimed it was not aware of it. Monsanto presented its Roundup herbicide-resistant corn at last year's National Agriculture Fair, Expo Chacra 2000, where the company, according to the information leaked to Greenpeace, also distributed the seeds, despite the fact that they were unapproved. Monsanto had applied for approval for the product already in 1999, but the Argentinian authorities had refused the permit because of export concerns as the variety is banned in Europe. While the U.S. corn industry suffered massive losses in the European and Japanese market over the past years because of contamination with GE corn, Argentina had subsequently become the primary exporter of corn to the European Union. Monsanto deliberately puts Argentinian corn exports at risk with this illegal action, said Emiliano Ezcurra of Greenpeace Argentina. Greenpeace was also informed that the case of illegal plantings was known within the Agricultural Secretariat as early as January this year. When confronted with the allegations, the authorities admitted that indeed unapproved GMO had been detected and were now being searched for and destroyed. The Secretariat refused to disclose the identity of the GMO, the quantities, the region affected, or the name of the company involved. Monsanto sneaking GMOs into Europe with Argentine complicity. Why did both the company and the authorities remain silent so long? There must be very close links between Monsanto and some officials in the Secretariat to continue this cover-up until we exposed it, as Kura added. This company simply doesn't play by the rules, but pursues a ruthless global strategy of legal and illegal contamination with genetically engineered seeds, said Benedict Herlin of Greenpeace International. Monsanto, a repeat offender smuggler without respect for any law. This case follows the same pattern as the massive smuggling of GE soybeans from Argentina to Brazil, where Monsanto's Roundup Ready soybeans are still illegal. Of course, Monsanto denies any involvement in this criminal action, but at the same time, Monsanto is involved in a massive public propaganda exercise for these seeds in Brazil, despite the fact that they are actually contraband. Monsanto is a very powerful company in our country, said Emiliano Ezcurra, but that does not mean that they are above the law. We demand a full investigation of these activities, and we demand that Monsanto be prosecuted and held liable for any costs resulting from this contamination. That was a report from Greenpeace, Monsanto's illegal GM corn found planted in Argentina, which can be found at the Greenpeace website, greenpeace.org.
Meanwhile, a media blitz to clean up the image of GMOs has been mounted, featuring so-called yellow rice, which is being touted as a solution to blindness caused by vitamin A deficiency in the Third World. An article in the New York Times revealed that the product's only purpose was as a PR stunt. Golden rice is an industry name for rice that was genetically engineered to contain more vitamin A. Because vitamin A deficiencies contribute to blindness in impoverished children, Monsanto and boosters of the biotech world cite this product as the reason to lower all our shields and allow the march of GE crops to continue unabated. Monsanto's public relations strategies were engineered to exploit this fact. The rice, which contained more vitamin A than natural varieties, was seized upon by Monsanto as a way to pressure the American public, and indeed the globe, into believing that by rejecting genetically engineered foods at home, they were condemning poor children to blindness abroad. But this guilt is quickly dissipated by the critical mind that considers these facts. A child would need to eat 15 pounds of this rice to meet his vitamin A needs. 78 grams of sweet potato leaves could meet the needs of vitamin A for children as well as addressing other nutritional concerns. Americans rejecting GE foods at home has nothing to do with growing super crops in Asia. This is common sense. People in Asia suffer from a lack of vitamin M, money, and if Monsanto was so concerned with their welfare, it could act to change that through natural foods for less money today. One of the co-engineers who developed golden rice, a Swiss scientist named Ingo Patikas, was very clear about what the miracle of golden rice is intended to accomplish. PR. He states, "The main agenda for golden rice is not addressing malnutrition, but garnering greater support and acceptance for GE amongst the public, the scientific community, and funding agencies." Unquote. Because Americans don't want genetically engineered food, companies like Monsanto are using guilt to tug at the heartstrings of the more prosperous West. Indeed, images of malnourished people in Africa, Asia, and India are effective tools, until, of course, the strategy of misinformation and manipulation is understood by the consumer. It's then that Monsanto and its engineered moral superiority are laid naked as deceptive and wrong, and the true burden of guilt is clearly placed where it belongs. This brings us back to the biotech experimental station that Cornell wants approval for in Geneva. Though Cornell claims that their experiments pose no risk, they refused to make their experimental projects public. Jeremy Alderson, host of the Nobody Show on WEOS, filed a Freedom of Information request that Cornell refused to honor. Jeremy took Cornell to court and recently won the first round of what is sure to be a long battle. Cornell receives major funding from biotech corporations and can be expected to use its deep pockets to appeal the ruling. Missy Globerman reported on the ruling in the May 22nd edition of the Ithaca Journal as follows.
Radio host wins lawsuit. Cornell must grant access to biotech research, judge rules. A state Supreme Court justice in Tompkins County ruled that Cornell University must provide access to biotechnology research documents requested by a public radio talk show host. Judge Robert C. Mulvey ruled Friday that Cornell's Agricultural Experiment Station is to be considered a state agency as per the state education law that states that the facility fulfills a state governmental function and is therefore subject to the Freedom of Information Law, FOIL. Therefore, in view of the court's obligation to construe the Freedom of Information Law broadly in order to achieve the goal of government accountability wherever and whenever feasible, the petition must be granted, the decision read. The petition was filed by Jeremy Alderson, host of The Nobody Show, your unabashed voice of the left and left out, broadcast on the Geneva station WEOS 89.7 FM. He filed suit in December after Cornell denied his multiple requests for information about the safety protocols and risks of the school's genetically modified food research projects. The university also denied his request for information about the firms that intend to be located in the proposed agricultural and technology park near the university's 800-acre Geneva Agricultural Experiment Station. Cornell argued that it did not have to provide such information to Alderson because of a precedent decision from 1999. In Stoll v. New York State College of Veterinary Medicine at Cornell University, it was decided that in certain instances, statutory college matters are not necessarily subject to the information law. Mulvey ruled, however, that the private and confidential staff disciplinary records requested in the Stoll case could not be equated to the information sought by Alderson. Quote, since the essential public purpose of the experiment station is agricultural research, unquote. Cornell's vice president for university relations, Heinrich Dulay, said it was too soon to say whether the university would appeal the decision. We have no hesitancy to provide factual information on GMOs and research that has been done and is being done in reference to them. There are separate legal questions about the applicability of the New York State Freedom of Information Law, and he applied for this information under that legislation, Dulay said. Pleased with the decision, Alderson said Monday, this is the first round, but I think it shows that Cornell's biotech work involves not just the abuse of science, but the abuse of power. Cornell says its work is safe, but one of the things that they are fighting tooth and claw to make sure no one sees is the very safety documents that might prove their claim. Alderson did not request and wasn't awarded a financial judgment in the lawsuit. Robert Freeman, executive director of the state's Committee on Open Government, cited a ruling similar to Alderson's suit in a case decided by the state appellate court in 1981, stating that Cornell's Board of Trustees must make the part of their meetings regarding the statutory colleges open to the public, as per the state open meetings law. Freeman wrote an opinion in September on the Alderson case that mirrors Mulvey's decision. The big university in this instance is similar to what so many people refer to as big government. FOIL is supposed to be a tool that can be used by anybody, and I congratulate Mr. Alderson on his use of FOIL as a citizen to know what the university under the control of the state is up to, he said. That was Radio Host Wins Lawsuit by Missy Globerman for the Ithaca Journal.
Jeremy also broke the story of the planned biotech park in Geneva to the listeners of WEOS, but others in the community who haven't heard his program might only have seen the pro-park articles in the Finger Lakes Times. Geneva's business community and city government have been seeing dollar signs in their eyes about the project and seeing little else, apparently. Opposition has grown as the word has gotten out, and the legislature's education committee held up the appropriation for the land as a result. The bill's backers, however, did an end run around the committee by attaching it to the version of the New York State budget that was passed by the Senate, but not to the version passed by the House. Though little progress is being made in resolving the differences between the two budget bills, sooner or later they will be reconciled. If we can keep it out of the budget, that may kill it for good, as it had been going nowhere before this desperate ploy. It's extremely important to let the budget negotiators know that there is strong opposition to the biotech park. Some budget items will be fought over. We can't let the assembly negotiators think that they can use it as a concession because no one cares about it. Contact Governor George Pataki, Assembly Majority Leader Sheldon Silver, Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno, as well as your representative and senator. At the beginning of this section of the show, we noted that the sabotage of GMO plantings and research by citizen activists has been termed terrorism by some and self-defense by others. It is always the case that whether one is a terrorist or a freedom fighter depends entirely on which side you're on. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is openly supportive of the development and expansion of agricultural biotechnology, and it sees its mission as promoting U.S. agriculture, which is now dominated by agribusiness. Its position is that acts of sabotage against GMOs constitute agricultural terrorism, and it has used the corporate media to promote that view. The USDA maintains several email discussion groups on agricultural policy. What I'm about to read you appeared in its discussion group on sustainable agriculture on May 23rd. The author is Michelle Gale Sinex. She wrote, "What is agricultural terrorism? Can you define agricultural terrorism? Or anyway, give some examples of what you have in mind when you use the phrase? I'm not clear on what you mean by that. By agricultural terrorism, do you mean the corporations of one nation having the power or threatening to starve another nation's people by withdrawing trade grain supplies for political reasons? Or when the corporations of one nation seek to replace the indigenous landrace crops of another nation's people with proprietary varieties, simultaneously replacing a commons social system with a licensing user fee-based one, so that food is no longer a gift of abundant land and focused labor, but a consumer product requiring participation in a cash economy? Or the corporations and policymakers of one nation driving its farmers off the land using urban-derived economic formulas for land valuation and debt, with no consideration or care about rural economic realities or the people who live there, even though the entire nation's economy runs on their work? Or a nation's media establishment propagandizing against rural people in general, representing their lives, work, and history with hostile, bigoted stereotypes of slack-jawed yokels, incestuous hicks, gap-toothed, gun-toting sodomites, spunky widows, and apple-cheeked farm wives? Do you mean a nation's corporations partnering with its public institutions to accrue private gain from publicly developed and held assets like seeds, soil, and multi-century agricultural knowledge, and the consequent destruction of cultural memory? Or agribusiness depending on the labor of families of desperately poor, unskilled, undocumented, wandering workers to provide lowest common denominator field work that can't be done by machines? Or perhaps the nation's powerful corporations deciding that it is profitable to package the byproducts of industrial processing as foods, feed it to people, but never test it for its health effects, and then blame the women for their breast cancer, the children for their hyperactivity, and everyone else for their obesity, and old people for dementia? By agricultural terrorism, do you mean tinkering with the genomic base of life on Earth in order to find the latest fad in marketing or profits, and destroying the careers and lives of anyone who questions that? Do you mean policymakers and industry groups ignoring the sound advice of scientists with decades of research on, say, the transmission of prions, allowing hundreds of thousands of new cases of brain-wasting dementia to develop among people who are being told by PR firms that their food is safe? Maybe an example of what you're thinking is the consolidation of food sectors, such as meat slaughtering and packing or grain processing, so that local communities must do what the corporations who hold these industries tell them to, at the risk of losing their economic base, their jobs, their homes, and their families? Or perhaps a corporation going into a rural community, seeking to site a major toxic waste-generating facility there, securing tax breaks from the community, hiring its workers, operating for a couple of years, then withdrawing, and leaving their environmental, economic, and social wastes behind? Maybe you mean the shipping of fruits, vegetables, grains, meats, and their derivative products back and forth across continents and the planet, adding value, i.e. profits for selected organizations, while using huge amounts of fossil fuel energy, holding the entire planet's ecosystems hostage to air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions, and holding consumers hostage to the fossil fuel industry as well as agribusiness? Or are you using the received definition of the term, derived from government and corporate interests, which means things like a handful of activists uprooting a few test plots of GMOs, an activist deconstructing a McDonald's, or of other nations' technicians developing microbes that could quickly unmask the fragility of a highly vertically integrated, industrial, fossil fuel-driven, monocrop, monovariety-based food system? Terror seems to be the densest element of the term agricultural terrorism. Whose terror are you referring to? Peace. Mish.
Chain reactions you're creating. All your dirty deeds mutating. All gonna come back on us someday. Well, I like my food to be organic. No tomatoes that are scorpionic. I guess I'm just old-fashioned in that way. So what you saying, minister? Don't you think it's kind of sinister? Is the profit margin all that you can see? You broke Mother Nature's golden rules. Now you're feeding kids in schools the fruits of the ungodly company.
Our program will come full circle as we return to the topic of anarchism and direct action. We'll conclude with an interview with Tim Rehm, one of those famous anarchists from Eugene, Oregon. In the wake of the 1999 Seattle anti-WTO demonstrations, quote, Eugene anarchists were widely portrayed in the mainstream media as a violent roving band bent on mindless destruction as they roamed from city to city. Tim is a documentary filmmaker and an environmental direct actionist. He spoke with Sue Supriano a few months ago in Berkeley, California, while roaming from city to city to screen his latest documentary, Pickaxe.
Tell us what's up for you right this minute. You're zooming here through Berkeley on your way from here to there doing what?
I'm on a 50-city national tour. I'm out looking for activists. I think that with the new administration and the White House and Congress all being controlled by Republicans, we can expect what little protections we've had on our public lands, our federal forests, to probably disappear quickly in this new administration. And I think that with the laws gone, what we're going to need to do is we're going to need to put our bodies between the chainsaws and the trees. And so I'm out looking for folks that want to do that or support that or tell those stories. The way I'm doing that is I'm showing my film Pickaxe and trying to lure people in to watch a movie and end up hopefully inspiring them and empowering them to go out and take action in the forested areas around their homes or in other ways that support that.
I don't know if everybody understands that only 5% of the forests in the United States are left. Is that right?
The latest numbers I've seen, I believe, from the Native Forest Council say it's down to 2.7% in the lower 48 states. And so I almost picture that 2.7 as like whether or not it will tick to 2.6 or 2.5 sometime in the next summer. It's amazing to think that we are down to that little of the original forest that covered so much of the lower 48 states when Europeans first came here. And yet that's where we're at. And the question is, those little pieces of forest land that are left, those little wild places, can we save them as ecosystem seeds? Not like a seed to a single plant, but a seed of biodiversity, an interconnected seed of multiple species that include the keystones at the top, things like lynx and fisher and marten and marbled murrelets and spotted owls and big interlocking networks of species. We have only a few places left, and the question is, are we going to find the strength in ourselves to save them, or are we going to let corporate America and the multinationals rip those pieces away for, you know, Staples office paper?
Really? Yeah, and cutting down old growth trees for toilet paper, that's sort of the most extreme. I did a show on that a few years ago. I don't know if it stopped.
No, I'm sure that's still going on. It's amazing to think, but in this current insane way of making decisions in this country and in the world, whatever pays best is what happens. And it turns out that if you can work the deal to get the subsidized federal forests cut, and you can do whatever you want with those logs. There's no restrictions on them. And if turning into toilet paper makes the most money that particular day, then that's what you're going to do with it. And it's amazing to think that that's the fate of some of the last of the oldest beings on the planet, but that's the way it's going. And, what we did with pickaxe is we tried to show an example of where when people really understand what's up and are really willing to stand up to it, they have a way to stop that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it. I think people don't understand. I often bring up the issue because I feel so sad. I mean, as you're speaking, I could just cry because I was just thinking about looking up at the sky and not seeing birds. Of course, younger people, well, you're a younger person, but you know about this, the changes that have happened. And I'm not a younger person, and I remember when it was very different. And I know that it was even more different before, like you said, before we Europeans came and cut down so many trees, and all that has really, really sped up. And, of course, that's a habitat. It's habitat for so many animals and beings, and it's affecting the weather and so very, very many things. Maybe you want to elaborate on that. But when I bring it up to people, they turn away because they know but don't want to know, or they really don't know. And it's actually the most upsetting thing to me, I think, is that the extent to which people don't seem to be concerned.
One of the things we've been talking about on this national tour that I'm engaged in, because after I show the movie, I have a chance now with the people having seen an hour and a half of citizen direct action that is victorious in saving 9,000 acres of forest. I have a chance then to meet people in a real special space. And one of the things I've been explaining to people is that when we look at the relationships in our lives that are based on trying to control someone, we are usually looking at unhealthy relationships. And that's our relationship to the earth. We are trying to control it. We're trying to turn forests into housing developments. We're turning, tall grass prairie into genetically engineered, monocropped, pesticide-sprayed corn so that we can make corn syrup, so that we can have soda, genetically engineered soda that everyone is drinking.
Which is horrible for you, of course.
Yeah, horrible for you and certainly not good for the earth. And then if we look at the relationships in our life that are primarily based on listening, where we're being listened to and where we're listening to the other, We're looking at healthy relationships there. And I believe that's the way we need to turn our relationship to the earth. We need to start listening to what the earth says. And you're right, it's extremely painful. If you're really willing to walk through the woods or walk down a city street and hear what the earth is saying, I think you're going to find that your first natural reaction is to turn away from that. Because those of us who are living our lives like our elected officials or our preachers or the newspapers tell us to live them are living in a way that's unsustainable. And I just define sustainability as if everybody on the planet were able to make the same choices that you make, would all of the ecosystems on the planet now be here 7 generations from now? And if not, we're living unsustainably. And if we're living unsustainably, that's painful. I mean, scientists are predicting now that against a background extinction rate of the past of maybe one species every 100 years, we're looking at 2 to 5 an hour. Now, that could mean that half of all the species on the planet are gone within 50 years. And there's a big fallacy around extinction. Everybody likes to point out that, extinction is natural. Extinction is normal, the scientists tell us. Every species goes extinct eventually. Well, think about the opposite. Every single living being on the planet right now represents an unbroken chain of non-extinction for as long as life has been on this planet, maybe 3 billion years. No matter what the universe threw at it, whether it was atmospheric changes or an asteroid hitting the Earth or competition with other species. Every single living being on this planet now represents a survivor. Ancestors survived everything. And so extinction for everything that's alive has been not natural for 3 billion years. And against that, in 50 years, for no real reason, for no public good, and without much public debate, we're ready to take away half of all those species' lineages, our brothers and sisters, for all time. And I can't believe that that's happening. And I can't believe that anything else could be more important than stopping that in its tracks.
And bottom line, we're taking away ourselves our children, grandchildren.
I mean, that's the other thing to think about is, you know, to what extent does this make the human species unviable? I mean, I don't really know what the likelihood is that the human species would go extinct. But let's suspect that even if it's remote, what else is important to people that doesn't rest on an assumption of the continued existence of the human species? For instance, is your religion, your spiritual practice important? Is your family important? The arts, history, ethics, morals, the law? If any of these things are important to you, they all assume that humans are going to continue to survive. And if we are now engaged in a lifestyle that threatens the very existence of human beings, isn't addressing that lifestyle primary to every single other thing that we hold dear and hold important? And so for that reason, I think that we need to really start listening to the Earth, aligning ourselves with sustainability, and taking some risks of our own privilege to stand up to what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something that you've been doing a lot of, Tim Rehm, is standing up, you and a lot of other activists. So tell us some stories about that and about the organizations and the actions that you've done, which are depicted in Pickaxe in a very good, very gripping kind of way, easy to watch. And Pickaxe is the name of the film, and we'll let you know in a while how you can order that film. See it around your neighborhood and show it to your friends. But anyway, some examples.
Mm-hmm. Well, the example that we depicted in Pickaxe is one of the greatest direct action stories that has ever happened in this country on forest issues, at least. There was an area that was off limits to logging because it was protected as a habitat conservation area for the northern spotted owl. But arsonists got a hold of it and burned 9,000 acres. And then the government said, well, now that it's burned, let's just go ahead and salvage it. We won't protect it as owl habitat anymore, even though there were numerous successful fledglings of spotted owls. You know, in other words, they were successfully breeding in that area right after the fire. But that didn't matter. The government saw its chance to get in there, and it got in there. So we took them to court, and we sued them because their environmental impact statement refused to address the issue of whether or not rewarding an arson with a timber sale was an issue that could affect other areas. And a federal magistrate ruled in our favor and held up the Warner Creek sale. And then Congress came along and passed something that we call the salvage rider that suspended all environmental laws regarding salvage. And salvage was very broadly defined. The President Clinton swore he would veto it, and then a few months later turned around and signed it. And so what that means is suddenly all environmental laws were pulled out from under us. A federal judge re-ruled and said no longer is there any protection from the environmental impact statement not being done correctly, and therefore government, go ahead and log it. So we took the road. There was only one road into that timber sale, road 2408, and before it was over, there were 10-foot-wide ditches in the road. There was a 10-foot-high fort with a 20-foot-high tower, a moat, and a drawbridge, and people built a couple of what we call tarpies, teepees made out of tarps, and folks lived up there through 10 feet of snow and 11 months, and a whole lot of direct actions all over the state of Oregon during that time. And ultimately, in some amazing twists and turns that take place at the end of the movie, Warner Creek is still there, and our motto, not one black stick, has been a realization since that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. And I saw the film, it was a few months ago, however, and I know that even though I'm an activist and I interview lots of people and I read lots of newsletters and journals about what's going on, I didn't really have a picture of what it was like. So it was really nice to have that picture in the film, Pickaxe. How do you feel that the media has been covering this? Do you think that most people know about all this activity going on and the positive results of it in terms of protecting forests?
Well, for the most part, the mainstream media is attempting to shut out these kind of stories as widely as they possibly can. It is the case that the media will attempt where they see some sensational type activity to take advantage of it. But other than that, you know, the actual concept of citizens breaking the law because the law is wrong, standing up and turning back corporations from their attempt to, you know, extract resources, as they like to say, but in reality just turn the earth into something other than living beings. Those kind of stories are not making it into the mainstream media. I mean, that's part of why the independent media movement and alternative media, everything from, you know, a high school kid's zine to us independent videographers and yourself with the radio shows that you work on, all of the stuff that's going on the internet, all of these ways of providing alternative information are so important, because the reality is the system is very well configured to allow a certain amount of dissent and a certain amount of change, but not fundamental. We are allowed to reform it around the edges, and that will be tolerated. But when we actually begin to challenge state and capital, we will find that we are thoroughly shut out from getting those messages across. I was in the Democratic National Convention in L.A., as you were, and I had reporters come up to me and say, "Why are you here?" And I would tell them, you know, I'm here to destroy state and capital and to change the world into a better place to live. And then they'd look at me funny, and I'd say, "But you can't use that, can you?" And they would shake their head no. And I say, "Here, I'll give you a soundbite you can use." And I'd go ahead and give NPR or one of these other radio stations a soundbite that they knew that they could get past their editor. And I see that time and time again in print. I can think of one interview I gave. It was a February 2000 Spin magazine, where actually what I wanted to say was actually thoroughly printed by a mainstream national media source. And everybody else coddles it and changes it and smooths it or misquotes it That's not just true of interviews. That's true of whole stories. Anybody that's been involved in the media, anybody that's been involved in activism watches their issue get turned completely 180 degrees when it finally gets reported.
Right. It's like it all happens in a very narrow little sphere when the questions are really monumental. I want to go back to that issue of how monumental the issues are when you're talking about, well, you don't know the about the possibilities of human beings going extinct. Well, I know that they're very high because we're spoiling our nest. We're dependent on, you know, there just runs out eventually. There's no way. And with global warming and this is one of the problems. However, as I'm saying, all this information people don't want to hear is that people going back to that too is that people don't want to hear it. So how to get more people involved? How to broaden the numbers of people who take these very serious things seriously.
Well, when I speak after Pickaxe, I have a leg up on anybody else, because I've just showed people over an hour and a half exactly how people can make a difference, just regular folks actually stopping the government dead in its tracks. But that's one of the ways people need to do it. They need to know that there are success stories out there. There are a lot of instances. And if anybody wants a success story, look what happened in Seattle. I mean, we have beat the WTO all the way back to Doha, Qatar. These people are running scared from us, you know?
That's a World Trade Organization.
Right, yeah. So in Seattle in 1999, the World Trade Organization tried to get together. And in short, they were trying to solidify unelected world government. And what people were able to do is to actually shut that meeting down for a significant portion of it and provide the space for enough public dialogue to really stop that agenda. And now, you know, every other city in the world practically doesn't want to have that, and they have to go to a really restrictive Arabian state where fundamental basic human rights are not well honored, and where there's only 5,000 hotel rooms for 10,000 delegates. They're going to keep them on ships offshore in Qatar. And so that shows you how people, yes, they can be extremely successful. And so with that in mind, the question is then, how are we going to be able to exactly affect that change now one-on-one? And I'm a big advocate of direct action.
I just want to interrupt and say that, and of course that struggle's not over yet, because now there's the FTAA. And as you were saying, there's now a global movement. But say more about that.
Certainly there's a global movement. I mean, we saw it in Seattle. We've seen it in a number of cities. There have been mass actions in Minneapolis, Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., L.A., Cincinnati, all those cities, at least since Seattle. And certainly Prague, where the IMF and World Bank met back in September 26th of last year. And Quebec is the next in that series, and it's going to be huge. And if folks are hearing this interview before that, April 20th, 22nd, they need to be involved. And if they're hearing it afterwards, they'll probably already know that what I'm saying is history is about to be made up there also. Direct action. It's just a simple concept that We don't look at oppression and wait for somebody else to solve the problem. We don't try to get government to solve it for us. We don't try to get the police to solve it for us. We don't wait for a nonprofit or a university to solve the problem. We step in with our bodies and do what we can, preferably as a community, enjoying affinity with one another, and we begin to address those problems. And the basis for being able to take that kind of direct action is understanding the dialectic between privilege and oppression. And we are privileged people. Most of us who are within earshot of this are privileged just by being human and in this generation, but we're many of us privileged by our white skin color. Those of us who are male are privileged by our gender. Those who are U.S. citizens are privileged by our nationality and that horrendous war machine that defends so-called American interests. And what we need to do is we need to look at where we are living off of that privilege and oppressing others as a result of it. Not directly, but it's there. You know, it's there maybe in the way that you're eating or the way you're transporting yourself or the kind of situation that you find yourself working in. And we need to ask whether or not we're willing to be a part of that privilege. And I think what we can do is we can start to study that and we can give that privilege up in many cases. And where we can't, we can turn that privilege to the service of stopping oppression directly. And for me, that's the whole range of tactics. I mean, some of it's reformist and some of it's engaging politicians. I don't think we live in a democracy, but that doesn't mean we can't have some effect on our government. But at the same time, I think that that's not enough because it's not the fundamental change that we really need if we're really going to have a sustainable world. And so I'm in favor of the whole range of tactics, all the way up onto the actual taking part of the machines of destruction themselves. You know, I think when it comes to my issues, like things like timber mills that are, you know, chawing up old-growth timber and turning it into paper, you know, we have 1 million people. We'll walk right up to that timber mill real peaceful-like, and we'll gently turn it into a big community space, and we'll cook food for people, and we'll hold dances, and we'll turn the timber mill into an art project. But as it is now, it's a couple of people that care so much and are willing to risk their life and liberty and sneak in the middle of the night and burn it down and sneak away. And we need to ask ourselves whether or not those people can't be supported in every possible way, because we have to stop these machines of destruction. And it's only the fact that there aren't enough of us involved, really, that are keeping it from being done in a very peaceful, sensible, sane way. Mm-hmm.
Well, my guest is Tim Rehm, who's an activist and a forest activist and a many multidimensional activist and also a director, most recently, of Pickaxe. Well, Tim, I've heard you defend anarchism, and that's a word that has a lot of most people don't have any idea what it means.
They're hearing about it now all of a sudden, aren't they? Yeah, I mean, I think it was probably the World Trade Organization that was the first big hit there. I mean, I come from an activist base of Eugene, Oregon, and I think we had a real unique, wonderful thing happen in Eugene, partly because of our success at Warner Creek, the direct action that happened in the movie Pickaxe. We had people with a biocentric viewpoint, a viewpoint that the way we should base our actions isn't about what's best for humans, it's about what's best for life, taking life and putting it at the center rather than human beings at the center or the top of everything. We had that biocentric viewpoint along with a stance of taking direct action meet up with a kind of an urban sort of punk anarchism and the intellectual primitivist anarchism of John Zerzan from Eugene, Oregon. And together, that kind of energy started to translate into things like mass street actions, more direct action, and more economic sabotage and a lot more critical analysis. And what we're starting to see now, I think, not just from the Eugene Green anarchist side, but all around the country, is a resurgence of the concept that government is inherently a big part of the problem. And that government is not there to serve the people, as we are told. I mean, I'll let you know that in the Declaration of Independence, which is not enforceable, it says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But in the Constitution, which is the law, it says life, liberty, and property. And property is what the law is about. It's about protecting property and protecting capital for those who have it. And that's what governments do. I mean, I think James Madison, one of the founders, explained when he was writing the Constitution that that's what it was all about. And that's what it continues to be about. It's just that we're fooled by all this this mock media that comes down from the mainstream. And so with an anarchist perspective and as an anarchist, what we're trying to do is we're trying to look at solutions that are homegrown, local, and don't require a state, don't require a massive government to impose them upon us. We believe that people, when they are left to their own devices, are able to engage in the kind of creative solutions in their own communities that far exceed anything that any government program is going to be able to do. So what we're looking to do is we're trying to disempower government. We're trying to disempower corporations In general, I don't think human beings need the amount of power they have because they don't yet have the wisdom to exercise it the way they are. We can create lots of little clever technologies, but we're not sure what they're going to do, and we're not using them very well. And so what we're looking to try to do is to try to end up with a system where people are providing the services that they and their neighbors need in their communities from their communities without any kind of government mediation. On the creative side, that's what we're doing. And on the destructive side, we're looking to try to bring down these big institutions, which are hampering our ability to do that in our lives.
Well, I should think you could get a lot of support for that, both from left and right, from conservative people and more radical people, actually. Of course, the stereotype version of anarchists is the, with the black mask and breaking windows, which might be part of it, but certainly, and might not, I don't know, but certainly not the major part.
Well, we have a second, actually, we have three titles that my group, Pickaxe Productions, along with Tim Lewis, myself, put out, and one of them is called Breaking the Spell. And part of the idea is that black masked person throwing a rock through a Starbucks window is breaking a spell. And it's a spell that corporate America has most Americans under. I mean, if you tried to imagine what it meant to be really human for a million years of human evolution and really get into that vision and then suddenly put yourself on a major American road walking down the street past the McDonald's and the Starbucks and with the cars zipping in every direction, you'll realize that you're living in a spell. And we have to break out of it. And when we break out of it, we can begin to see what the earth is all about, and we can begin to see what's real. And from that position, we can begin to take strong action. And I think that's what the breaking of the windows is all about. I mean, of course, it's also about the direct action of depriving these people of the profits that they hold so dear. But it's also has that strong effect of waking people up. And so, I mean, that's just one side of it, of course, because as I said, for every bit of the destructive energy that anarchists engage in, they're engaged in guerrilla gardenings and food not bombs and info shops and all kinds of free community spaces, ways that, again, we can provide the things that we need in our community ourselves without requiring the exchange of money and without requiring a government to do it for us. Mm-hmm. We don't think that works.
Yeah. And, of course, even the little bit of violence is so tiny compared to the violence that all these things do, that the government does.
Right. I mean, we need to understand we're living in a very violent world. The way that the products in our grocery stores are brought to us, the way that people are, you know, the Indonesian sweatshop worker's life is a violence against the Indonesian sweatshop worker. It's violent against the forests of the world. It's violence against people of color. We live in a society that's violent against women. And so it's from the basis of this very violent society that we're trying to stop that we think breaking a window could hardly be called violent.
Really? Well, we just have a couple minutes left, and we want to be sure to let people know how they can get your film. That's how I got it. I ordered it.
Well, so Pickaxe Productions can be reached at either www.pickaxe.org or at 1-888-PICKAXE. And in both of those cases, you'll get a list of our three titles, RIP WTO N30, Breaking the Spell, and Pickaxe.
Well, just to make a circle here in our last remaining seconds there, how many trees remaining from the original trees in the continental United States?
The latest number I saw is 2.7% of the lower 48's forests are left. That's what we're fighting for.
Pretty serious. Well, thanks very much for your work, Tim Rehm. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end for my guns.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
To help these poor